I'm Dwayne Addison. Our concern is Christians and Indians, and the focus tonight to be on present conflicts. This is Tuesday, June 21st, 1983. Welcome. Again, the broad concern is justice, fair treatment for all of our citizens, and the focus today will be on how it is today. And what I'd like to share in my introductory part are what I would call Indian perspectives. Now, one of the first things we deal with is there is no Indian point of view. Asked, you know, what do Indians want? You cannot begin to answer that because there are many viewpoints. If you know a half dozen different Indians, you know, it's like talking to a half dozen different other people. They will have different concerns, differently expressed, different tribes, so forth. But several years ago, I spent some time as my job to listen and to interpret in behalf of the churches or to the churches what some of these major concerns were. Had connections with some national Indian organizations, tribes outside of South Dakota, some national connections on that, and worked with people in Indian education. And I briefly want to share about a dozen of these concerns. The words are mine, the perceptions are mine, but I hope they are representative of a significant number of Indian people in our country. One of those that I did not put down on the list that I discovered was very urgent, and I don't know why I missed it, because I was aware of it, is the issue of criminal justice, fair treatment in the court systems, and this is a very important thing in South Dakota, and I assume in many other areas as well. If I don't develop that, I want to pick up some other ones here. The number one issue that I've heard again and again in a variety of ways is captured by a word, survival. Just simply human survival. Keeping your kids alive, your family together. But a survival in another dimension as well that is becoming increasingly prominent among Indian people. We might call it cultural survival. That is an interest to survive on our own terms. Not simply as Indians, but as Mohawks, or Cherokee, or Lakota, or whatever the tribe or the nation might be. An increasing resistance to the pressures of the melting pot idea that we talked about last night. Increasing pride in heritage. I think a part of the larger number of Indians indicated in the last census is fantastic. You can't have that many kids that are there because people who were partial Indian ancestry now really are proud to identify themselves as such. And a wish, whether they're urban or on reservations, to make their own decisions, to survive in that sense. Will the rest of America allow this? Is one of the issues of conflict. I think it's one of the deepest ones of all, as some conversation indicated afterward last night that affirmed that idea. A second theme that comes up, and these sort of flow as I put them together, the idea of self-determination. That is, that Indian people, like the rest of Americans, should have the power to shape their own future. We've assumed this. This is a part of the American dream. But the major theme that I think that runs through history for over a century and more for most of our Native American sisters and brothers is the decisions have been made on their behalf by their friends, but primarily by the federal government. We mentioned last night that theme that seems to be around yet, but very powerful a generation ago, of termination. And it ought not to be confused with that. That is the idea of getting the government out of the Indian business. More complicated than that. But here, simply the power to shape your own future. A third theme. And that really leads, as they get progressively, into controversy. The issue of treaty rights that this little sheet talks about, and very difficult for ourselves to understand. But perhaps one of the most important things the rest of America can do, and its agencies of government, particularly the federal government, is simply to honor the word, or they would say the law of the land. Much of the relationships and the legal doctrine that is there and the practical relationships are based on treaties that have been negotiated and the language between different nations, although one nation was much bigger and inclusive of them. And the first step to deal with these most Indian people would say, is simply to begin to honor particularly the spirit of those solemn obligations that have been made in the past, to keep its promise. There's a great deal of history behind this. Justice John Marshall, back in the 1830s, when he had his conflict with the executive branch of government, he said, the whole meaning of what America is involved in this. If we are a nation who deliberately breaks our promises to peoples, then the meaning of America is lost. And he felt it was a moral issue. It is more than that for American Indians. It's a part of that issue of survival. And so several of our church bodies have endorsed our Indian communities and said, this is where the churches also are friends of the court, so to speak, to work on that side of them. And it's got them in some troubles in some places, by the way. A fourth theme, many of these are in the legal area, but these are important, particularly for Indian people on reservations or near reservations. The fourth theme I would lift up is that of trust responsibility. A concept that says there is a peculiar or special obligation of the people, and particularly the government of the United States, for Indian people that other people do not have. To our ears, does that sound right? But again, this is based on those treaties. It is based on the succession of land. And this is the other part of the obligation or the agreement that was made. A responsibility that is for the whole government, but put primarily in the hands of the U.S. Congress. A responsibility that Indian people will say, and again, has not been very well fulfilled, particularly by that agency that's been designated to serve them most especially, the Bureau of Indian Affairs. I want to come back to that bureau in a moment because there are ambivalent feelings toward that, and you may be familiar with some of these as well. But the idea that there is that special relationship that Indian people have, or Indian tribes have, to be technical at that point, that the rest of us do not have. And so you saw laws to try to remove that trust responsibility or destroy the promise of those obligations. The legislation will often be cast in saying, you know, everybody has equal rights and responsibilities. But hidden behind that language is the taking away of that obligation, the promise that is there. At least this is what Indian people have suggested. A fifth theme, and this flows from this, the idea of tribal sovereignty. About half of Native Americans live on or very near reservations, and so they exist under the rule of their communities with their own government, separate governments, sometimes overlapping that with our local communities or our counties or our cities. And again, the feeling that that must be affirmed. And the idea that that sovereignty or that independence or that power to rule themselves is something that is inherent. It is not something granted to them, but that has been recognized by the government of the United States. The Supreme Court and our federal courts have largely recognized this idea, but perhaps many of our citizens and ourselves have dismissed comfort with that as well. Much more could be said on each of these, but let me just sort of list them out and open it up to see what the conflicts are for us. That leads to another one, and this is probably one of the great areas, perhaps around here the greatest area of conflict, of jurisdiction. What happens when you have these overlapping areas of sovereignty or of control over people or over a territory? Who's in charge? Who provides the services? In most of the reservations outside of the Southwest, you probably have as many or as nearly as many non-Indians as Indians living on that. Who provides the services for law enforcement? The protection, the other kinds of services that government provides. If you're a white living on a reservation in South Dakota, you don't elect the tribal leaders, but somehow you have to abide by many of their regulations. Or often it's the other way around. How can you be treated fairly in these situations? And I could give a host of illustrations all the way from the East Coast to here in which conflict has arisen. And I would just sort of say personally at that point, the concern is for justice for all who are involved. And non-Indians as well as Indians felt that they've been unjustly treated. You know, taxation without representation is an ancient cry. And so some of my white friends in South Dakota just don't like to pay those taxes that they have to pay on reservations in some of these places. But Indian people have felt we've lived under this system for a long time. But it's yet to be resolved. Another related issue, the issue of land. We talked briefly about reservations yesterday. There are a number of special attachments that many Indian people feel for their land. Not only is a territory where they've been allowed to be themselves, to be relative independent, there's a kind of blessing being separated from the rest of society. And Indians joke about going back to the res. And in many ways, that's a good thing. For many people, that the land they now live on is a portion of their original land that has been reserved, that is set aside for their primary use, sometimes their exclusive use. And there is a kind of a spiritual bond that they have to that very soil. A different sense than most of us have. But land is also the base from which people like Vine Deloria, right, and many others here, on which the future can be built. Two things we have, he says, we have a land base and we have largely intact elements of our culture. And with these, if we're allowed the room, we'll be able to build again and take our place on the American scene. A hopeful sign. But that leads to another concern of conflict. I suggested several years ago, and I made these notes, that perhaps for the coming decade, the decade of the 80s, this would be the major conflict. Indian-controlled resources. Most reservations are on remote parts of the country, at least when they were formed, where there are few resources of moisture, good land, other things that were needed at the time. But lo and behold, by some quirk of fate or design of God or something, Indian tribes control some of the most valuable real estate in the country. Probably over half of our uranium reserves are Indian controlled. Many of the waterways or the water resources, other mineral and energy resources. I have an article here written by a friend of mine several years ago that suggested that we're having repeating now something like the land takeaway of a century ago, but now it is a takeaway, with the BIA being very helpful in most cases, of those energy sources. We here with an energy shortage would probably be scared here because those things, and the word comes along that we'll all benefit from that, and the Indian people are only a small minority, and certainly they would do their part to help the rest of us. In many ways, it's like the old John Wayne adage. I don't know if you know John Wayne and his movies. He's killed more Indians than anybody else in the world in these movies. And I always joke to my classes that we should begin and do the whole course by watching John Wayne movies. And I joked about it, and still do, I guess, until I read an interview with John Wayne, bless his memory, Duke. The attitude that he expressed in those films was his personal attitude. I don't know which had come first. The Indians did a disservice to America by selfishly wanting to hold on to those lands. And they ought to let it good let be used for those who knew how to use it. And so we did no wrong in taking it from them. I don't know. But the day that conflict is coming up again, I think, in another form. Another issue. Let me complete these in a few moments. Development of reservations. One of the toughest ones. What future will there be for Indian people if they're allowed some degree of this control of their own lands, that we honor to agree these treaty rights? Can they make it go, practically speaking, economically speaking, on reservations? Can they become viable, self-sustaining units? I don't know. I'm somewhat hopeful. I wouldn't say modestly hopeful on that. Of allowance for making one's own mistakes, a phasing out of government assistance, but keeping that for the time being in one form or another, perhaps in many areas this can be done. But a tough one. At least that's true in South Dakota. And again, another one. What about the federal government's part of this? There are a number of things involved here. I would title it here, The Federal Delivery of Services that have been promised in treaties and promised by law. When some of these laws were made or the treaties were made, it was assumed that the Indians would sort of phase out and another generation there wouldn't be any. The whole idea of allotting land, for example. If you think about it, if anybody thought about the future, what crazy sorts of thing would be if you allow a male adult head of a household 160 acres and there are going to be some marriages and intermarriages and kids coming down several generations, would you get where you're at today? Some of my friends joke about that. They get their check from the government, the only check they get, really. They're allotment checks. And so they'll own a few acres here and from one ancestor and a few acres there and maybe a dozen different parcels of land that they cannot possibly control or use. And so the Bureau of Indian Affairs collects that money for it from leasing the land to others and sends them their check. And that whole mess, because somebody didn't think about the future. But that's a little aside at that point. What about the Bureau of Indian Affairs? Nearly every Indian person I know in one breath will damn it. The bureaucracy that has not fulfilled its obligations, but yet they usually feel that something like the Bureau, changed radically, many would say, is necessary, at least for the time being, to fulfill the obligations that have been made in the treaties and the promises that are made in laws. Another note, only about half of the Indians now live on or near reservations, or we'd call reservation Indians. And the whole series of concerns that surround their needs. Off-reservation Indians, these would include many of those living in Sioux Falls, for example, where I am at. The great populations of Indians living in Los Angeles or in the Bay Area or Phoenix, or an imagined Seattle. It was assumed when Indians moved to the cities that they would blend into the rest of the society and have the same services, and that would all work out. Largely, it has not. And maybe some of you want to comment upon this. In fact, there was a part of the process of termination that was sort of in vogue in the 1950s. That the Indian problem would be solved in large part by moving these Indians, these excess populations from the reservations to great areas like Chicago. And you would train them for vocations. I know a lot of Indian people, including women, know in their 50s and 60s, or in their 60s now, that are excellent welders. They're prepared for that job. There's a joke in the Indian communities when the first shot went off to the moon that you ought to send an Indian to the moon because you can be certain that they'll come back. Because if you send an Indian off to Minneapolis or Chicago, they're going to be coming back to the res. And whether good or bad, there's a great deal of truth to that. And the program, again well-intentioned, has not seemed to work well. These needs, in terms of education, human needs, are a big problem before us. And finally, one whole bag of issues. And when I've shared this, other friends have said, that deserves special treatment in itself, and I just title it Indian Well-Being. And sometimes I would start from that. A whole host of concerns that many other Americans share, but Indian people seem to be benefited by or harmed by, that's the word I really want to use, more than others. Health and health care is the worst for any group in the United States. Chemical dependency, and particularly alcoholism, is an overwhelming problem in nearly all Indian communities. All, I would suggest, but I don't have, you know, the exact, but I'm not surprised if it would be. Inadequacies of education, whether it's on the reservation or off. Employment, that goes back to that development concern, but it's more complex than that. Some reservations in South Dakota have over, in the wintertime, over 80% unemployment. And the only gainful employment there is provided by the governmental systems. Again, the Bureau, the educational systems, and the things that are there. Welfare, that is meeting human services for Indian people. How are these to be dealt with? Maybe it's a concern for the rest of Americans as well, but for Indian people, it seems a tougher thing. In the last few years, it has become worse. A good friend of mine, the last word I want to share at the moment, I mentioned last night, Gene Crawford. who is from the Sisseton Reservation in South Dakota. And he wants to maintain his contact with his people and his relatives. He's got a lot of them up there. And he comes back and he usually visits me in Sioux Falls after he's been there. Shattered. Because of the struggle, again, go back to number one. Simply to survive. What are the answers to these sorts of things? We're going to talk about the next section, and I promise tonight the issue would be in terms of conflict, but the conflict is set in this larger setting of human beings with human needs in a common community in the United States of America. And the other area I just mentioned that it was not on these notes, but the issue of criminal justice in the sense of unfair treatment is the other issue that I would add. Those things, as I interpret them, attempting to faithfully listen to the voices of Indian people. Perhaps biased because they come from tribal people, national organizations, those who are articulate and advocates, those working in Indian education. But I hope fairly representative of our Indian sisters and brothers. Where should we begin? I'll repeat your questions or concerns if they're not heard well. Where are you at? Where are the points of contention? Where are the needs that are urgent? Yeah, Beth.
What are some treaty rights that are being broken today that we as whites should know about?
The treaty rights, I think, largely perhaps in terms of land. Each treaty is different, but there's some common patterns of most treaties that were made for Indian people to cease hostilities and to go into prescribed area. The treaty is typically provided for education, protection of the federal government, and oftentimes it specified certain types of other services that would be there. But imagine the main area that would be concerned with would be, you know, the protection of the land that is there.
When you mention natural resources, where are we right now in that? I mean, I can't see us going over to Saudi Arabia and telling them we want their oil. You know, not paying for it. Is that what we're doing to the Indians?
Mm-hmm. let me give some examples. That's the other article that I just mentioned in passing, and that's a couple of years old, and those things are changing. And because it's my memory, because we drove through these reservations on the way out, and we talked a bit about it in our car, as its trust agent, and the ones who negotiated and worked with the tribes, for example, in the Northern Cheyenne Indian Reservation in southeastern Oklahoma, a very small tribe that has immense coal deposits there, and it became a tribal controversy. That land was leased to a major coal company with very small return for the Indian tribes. You know, and you have as your friends or your agent the federal government at that point, and worked out which could be seen in retrospect as a sweetheart deal for a major coal company. That one has been renegotiated. And that is happening again and again, and that's the real point of controversy. And so you have a pattern that is similar towards arrangements in other parts of the world in which major companies come in and get arrangement with the assistance of the U.S. government with little return for the tribe. Sometimes those tribal leaders that are there get some benefit out of it, and so tribal politics enter into it as well. Or one of the most blatant cases deals with the development of uranium in northwestern New Mexico, in which a major company, I'm not going to mention names now, but you can name some very familiar names here, in which Indian people were there and were contaminated without their awareness or their knowledge here. Again, that in addition to a little return for the tribe. And so the issue is there in terms of energy. Indian people will say, we should have our own decision, whether we should develop or whether we should postpone it. And if we do develop, that the control will be largely in the hands, as with other communities, you know, over the use of the land or the restoration of the land. Some may choose to develop, but I assume many would be under those pressures because they need those resources for their education and their health. But that pressure should not be made from the outside. Yes?
I think in the state of Washington, it's helpful to be aware that, that Senator Slate Gordon has made a career out of an anti- decommercialization of the steelhead fishery.
Yeah.
All the Indians have commercially fished steelhead since they got that right reestablished in the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
So that whole fishing thing, as long as he was secretary or attorney general of the state.
And now he is your congressperson or one of your congressmen. Oh, your senator, pardon me, okay, yeah.
And somebody, I think, on this issue to be watched very carefully. And then on the resources, just in northeastern Washington, and I can't think of the tribe now, they are sitting on large coal reserves. There's a controversy about how that's going to be developed and who's going to do it. There's a lot going on in this state.
So have you heard this? You know, Washington, to the point of controversy and the issue of salmon fishing, but also in the terms of coal reserves. And you mentioned your senator here, who has been anti-Indian career on that. Okay. Other point, Phil.
You indicated yesterday the federal courts and the churches were viewed positively by Indians.
Yes.
And I wonder, where are they when, or where is the church, where is the federal court system when these so-called sweetheart deals are occurring. Seemingly they occur so frequently.
Yeah.
How does it happen if there really is a sincere interest on the part of the Lutheran Church?
There probably has been enough here or as urgent. And these things and these sweetheart deals, I think, are things only recently discovered. Working with this, there are more and more, the Indians are taking charge of these things themselves, and they're getting the expertise. Let me mention a couple groups at this point. There's a group called Native American Rights Fund that hires some of the best lawyers in the country that assist tribes at the service of tribes of dealing with these issues and provide the technical assistance for them to deal with it. And the churches have worked with this, providing support and sort of as partners, that justice is done in terms of that. Another area, and the churches haven't been too much involved in this, as far as I know. There's a group called, I think it's Consortium of Energy Resource Tribes, CERT is the initial, and a number of the tribes with these resources have banded together, got their own technical people and their own things, and we'll do our own research and not depend upon the federal government, which has not come through many times, or oftentimes they've gone to court or to challenge it or to arrange it publicly to force the federal government. In this case, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, to do what their job ought to be. And the church, I think, in these issues has not been a part, you know, at the center of the issue or the support of this. But, you know, they voiced it, and that's important.
There's one other thing that occurs to me in this state, which is not directly, in one sense, an attempt to usurp Indian lands on the Yakima Reservation. Sometime in March, there was a cutoff at the time that the Department of Energy could explore virtually without any question where they were going to store nuclear waste.
Mm-hmm.
They attempted to drill a test site on the Yakima Reservation. The Yakima is pretty sophisticated legally, so and they stopped that so that they couldn't get started in time to grandfather the attempt. And so the Yakima tribe is now really taking a leadership role in helping people to understand what's going on at Hanford in terms of the barrier of nuclear waste.
Mm-hmm.
And I was at a meeting that they held. They called together a lot of people from the church and other conservation and those kind of people. And helped me to see that, you know, the only reason we're doing stuff at Hanford is because when we developed atomic energy for the bomb. It couldn't be reached by bombers from either Japan or Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Geologically, there's never been a reason to have nuclear resources developed at Hanford.
Okay.
The geology won't support what's going on there. And to have the Indians with their view of the sacredness of the land, you know, they're really doing some pioneering work. So in one sense, they're running interference, I think, for the sake of all of us in this case. But that's going to be a big controversy in this state over federal policy. because the federal government seemingly wants to, without any regard to the geology, to place nuclear waste material in Hanford.
Mm-hmm. Brought together, interestingly, Indian people, conservationist people, ranchers, residents of the hills, you know, as one side of that issue. And Indian people, I think, will be working along others to try to preserve many lands, not only their own, but that the land ought to be held in trust for all the people. And I think that voice will be raised. You say the Yakima Nation is taking the leadership in the state of Washington at that area and inviting others to work with them at that point. Yes?
Southwestern Indian tribes who are filing a claim for riparian water rights on the Colorado River adjoining their land, which is going to the federal courts in the next few months. And of course, on the opposite side will be a rather substantial organization like the Metropolitan Water District based in
Los Angeles. Okay. Okay, he said the controversy in the Colorado River. He said five tribes from the southwest and along that, and this is coming up to the courts, and the major party on the other side, the Metropolitan Water District, you know, what has made Los Angeles of the water from the Colorado River. And where do you see that going, besides going to courts?
Well, I assume it'll end up at the Supreme Court. If the decision is in the favor of the Indian tribes, it would most certainly go to the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
Bureau of Indian Affairs will be able to afford the type of litigation fees that are required.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes the Justice Department has decided to go and to take the case on behalf of Indians, but that's not been the typical pattern, I believe. I know in the case, you know, this is way away from Maine here, there's some illegal treaties, and the Justice Department belatedly came in and took the side of the Indians here on this matter, and then finally that was settled out of court, and I think, you know, quite fairly, but that became a controversial issue there. But water, according to treaty rights, legal doctrine, court cases, Indians have certain rights on that water. They often have not used them, and that's another part of the story, and so other groups have come in, and the Colorado is widely used, and now the whole Southwest depends upon that, of course.
It's a very hot subject right now, because yeah. Central Arizona project is completed. And at the same time, like, this claim has been filed, so that you can expect some substantial help opposing it from Southern California.
From Southern California?
I mean, not only Metropolitan Water District, but a number of other, the three major irrigation districts, which take 85% of the Colorado River water that goes to California, certainly play a part opposing the claim by the tribes.
Okay.
It's quite a subject.
What would it mean, she asked, if the Indians did win their claim in court?
Well, they would, of the five tribes, I think they would get roughly about a half a million acre-feet a year, which is considerable, which could be the, they could develop their land.
Mm-hmm.
They have half none of this.
Yeah, they've had the rights to it, but they have not used it, and that's part of the controversies, you know, in our state, you know, that Indian people have access to Missouri, but they have not used it, and then the state moves ahead and develops that land, is oblivious to the Indians' claims, and I don't know if the Indians are going to, South Dakota are going to do it, but here in Arizona, they will, in many places, that they'll take up their cause on that. What is justice in a situation like that? What is justice? What is fair for... Because water is very limited, as you know.
We have broken our treaty with the Indians in the past. Water is a highly politicized subject in the West.
Probably the most.
Particularly in the Southwest, why they cannot exist without it.
Mm-hmm.
What's happening right now, Phoenix and Tucson, for instance, are buying up agricultural land near the Indian tribes to get the groundwater rights to take care of domestic purposes in those two cities. So So groundwater is being taken away and mined without being recharged to equal what is being withdrawn. It's the whole thing in the southwest United States, and particularly the lower Colorado free states, used to be seeing, I think, some headlines on it.
Okay. Coming controversies, he mentions, in the southwest states, they depend upon the Colorado and the using up of the groundwater that are not being replenished. You know, if you're in Tucson, for example, that what future is there for Tucson?
Is there another source of water then for Southern California?
Well, here's our water expert. Is there another source for Southern California? And that's
in water language, anything that is foreseen as being necessary in 25 years is not considered imminent. The way Southern California will take care of this proposed temporary shortage, if they want to call it that, would be by the storage of water above the 10 major dams of the Colorado River. I must mention this. The Colorado River impounds behind 10 major dams 4 times as much water that it runs off every year. So the present town metropolitan water district is planning on this storage capacity to benefit them, because at the moment the upper Colorado states don't need all this water.
Mm-hmm.
Your question is trying to answer it in Southern California right now. You may recall the Hurricane Canal proposition a year ago this month, where they wanted the big diversion of water from the San Joaquin Delta in Northern California down south, which was defeated. And then in November, there was another Proposition 13 that came up to create...
Different Proposition 13.
Yes, to create a water agency with the agency 5 members appointed by the governor to rule on all groundwater in California, and that was defeated.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the western states do not have groundwater laws, only Idaho has.
But
it's a complex subject, what will happen in Southern California.
Then just as a complex subject, Indians are often involved in this, sometimes not, but because they have legal rights to that, according to court cases. And if they exercise them, that will, for the rest of the people in Southern California or the Southwest, it'll, complicate the thing from their point of view. Just let me add one note connected with the churches. There is a situation down in central Arizona, just north of Phoenix, in which there are plans, a part of that central Arizona project, to dam up and really to flood a whole Indian reservation, a very small reservation in terms of numbers. But under leadership of church people and others, and a Lutheran-related agency, by the way, it was galvanized, and that action was prevented. There are alternative ways of dealing with that. But the political power of the state, heeded other voices rather than Indian voices up until that point. And, there are many, many facets of that. And water is probably the biggest factor in the West now. Yeah. Other concerns? Yes. Right. Navajo.
Now, is there a tribal council of those Navajo Indians that have jurisdiction or reserve Indians? I don't understand how an area that size, for example, how are the affairs comfortable in that? If I want to set up a motel, who can go to see? Or do?
I would suspect that you have to deal finally with the tribal council of the Navajo Nation. And they're a part of the center of the controversy. As you're from the Southwest, you know that the longtime administration of the Navajo Nation has been voted out of office. And my impressions are largely because of these, their decisions that have been unpopular with a significant number of people. But if you're going to do any development or anything else, there is a great deal of power in the Navajo Nation. The Navajo Nation has allowed the Great Power Project, huge in the Four Corners area, for example, that provides power for southwestern part of the states in that area, too. It's not only the water, but the coal that provides the power. So even when there has been pretty strong Indian control, you know, the question is raised by Indian people themselves whether the rights have really been protected. And so there's division with the Indian community at that point.
What's the so-called pecking order between Bureau of Indian Affairs and Navajo Indians in regard to the particular area such as we're talking about? Is there, do they have simultaneous responsibility, or is Bureau of Indian Affairs the one that has the top decision-making, or is the Navajo Tribal Council? What seems to be a lot of these things must have come because of conflicting areas of responsibility.
There are no clear lines of responsibility. Let me add my note, and others want to add on that. For a long time, the decisions are pretty much theoretically in the hands of one person, that is the Secretary of the Interior. And through him, the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the agencies and those decisions were made. Since the 1930s, when Indian nations were allowed or Indian tribes to establish their own governments, there has been self-government with limited control. In the last decade or so, well into the 70s, there's been legislation and development of the Indian community for more control. And what you have now, I think, is a great deal of confusion on that. That's a part of it, I believe. Right. To clarify those, to make certain who has the authority. I talked about the issue of jurisdiction. It seems for me as an outsider, for example, that one could begin to make compacts in terms of police control or to negotiate that and to allow that power of the tribe. But there is hostility, resentment, there are other ends that are involved, and it is awfully difficult to come by. And confusion is the name of the game in most places, it seems. It depends what kind of title you have. A great amount of Indian land bears no taxes, and that is due to historic rights on that. And therefore, that presents other problems. You don't have the tax base to support government or schools and so forth, and that is developed historically because that, in a number of places, Indian do have title of the land that pay their taxes, so it's not a universal thing at that point. Somebody else is going to share back. Yeah.
In Wisconsin, the reservation we live next to, there are all land sales in that, current land sales, the deed and title of that land has to clear through the tribal council and superior.
To the tribal council, yeah.
That is the last stop. If you don't get it there, you don't buy that land.
Okay.
The problem, I guess, to come back to that, and this is a very small scale problem. The problem that occurred up there is that the land was desirable now from a white perspective because it had the primus lake shore of it.
Oh, yes. You know that. Did you go to Lac de Flambeau, for example?
It was not given that land because it was important.
Yeah.
Now that's changed. And the problem is that, let's say yourself, you buy a cottage for a $100,000 summer home. You're from Chicago. Buy that home on there, and 3 months later, somebody knocks on your door and tells you that your title is not clear or anything like this.
Or you're going to be stuck with some taxes on it.
And some of those are traceable that, in fact, somebody was defrauded about 4, 5, 6, 7
right.
Facts 75 years ago. Now, how do you reconcile that? Because it's rightfully belonged to the Indian who first sold it, he was defrauded, but what do you do with the guy that's sitting there holding the bag in 1983?
Yeah.
What do you do with it?
I think the word you used is the good one, reconcile, because it's going to involve reconciliation and perhaps apart from the courts. That's the way it was, well, I don't know if it's solved, but the movement direction of solving it in the case of Arizona, I'm in the wrong end of the country, in terms of Maine. You discovered the state of Maine, which is then a part of Massachusetts, had made treaties with the Indians, Penobscot and Passamaquoddies up there, and they sort of legally, you know, 60% of the state of Maine belonged to these Indian tribes. What were you going to do? And what happened, you know, that people joked about it, but all of a sudden the title companies couldn't give you a clear title to the thing, and all of a sudden the problems were there. And the Indians all along said a small group were willing to negotiate. It was their policy that no individuals would be harmed. And by the great majority of that land was owned by paper companies, by the way, and in taking it to litigation, you know, you may have to threaten that, just created more hostility and enemies, became a political football. Lo and behold, Senator Muskie, who was an Indian lover, all of a sudden was the other side of the fence. That was the change that came in those times. But they were willing to negotiate. And I think, you know, reconciliation in most cases is possible, and I've seen cases of that. But no guarantee, yes, and then the final word. Well, the school system is a complex thing on that, but most Indian reservations or communities have some sort of self-government. That was restored back in the Indian Reorganization Act of 1934. Sometimes the model of government is not a good one, but for you know many decades, they had no self-government at all. And now most Indian community reservations do have that. But where does the jurisdiction lie in terms of the federal government? The other governments are there, and that, you know, is a very tangled situation. One last word, and then we'll close shop. Oh, maybe get two of them. Yeah.
On a positive note,
quick word.
Ken Smith, who is the Assistant Secretary of the Interior of Indian Affairs, comes from our state of Oregon, and he was the catalyst in developing the Warm Springs tribe to its present state. He's an MBA out of Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
He served on the board of the San Francisco branch of the Federal Reserve System. He went to Weyerhaeuser, and the chairman of that company owned a sawmill and a timber operation near the tribal land. And it was turned over to the tribal group, and they were afforded the opportunity to pay for it out of revenues. Then from there they developed Conita, this famous tourist center. Tremendously successful thing run by the tribes. Then they built a dam on the Deschutes River and are selling that power to Pacific Power and Light. It's perhaps one of the greatest success stories in tribal industry.
Okay. Yeah, he's illustrating in Oregon a success story, and the key person in that is now the number one man for the Indian Affairs in the country, Ken Smith. Yeah. One last word, and then we'll have to break. Yeah.
Is anything happening that's improving those areas, or if not, what are the factors that could happen to improve those situations for the Indians?
Efforts are being made, they've been made all along. I think they've found ways of Indian-specific types of alcohol programs, because they found out the typical Anglo programs, as we'll call them, have not been too successful. And I have friends that worked in this area, and that's an uphill battle, and they feel that unless this area is dealt with effectively, the other issues don't come. Employment is related to the development issue, particularly if you're on the reservation. And I don't think much progress has been made on that. You know, there are successful ventures, but a long ways to go.
Will it have to be employment within the reservation, or will it have to be the outside community?
It has to be both. Many areas. There's crying need for certain types of skills on the reservation. If you had people with business management skills or people in education or healthcare, you know, the positions are there, they're needed, and I think they would do much better than others. And so for that type of level of training, I think, you know, the crying need. Other things, there have to be development of industry on or near the reservation. That'd be part of the answer in it. Okay, time to break. We have to shut up. Thank you very much.